at the time was that Park Service had dug up some bones. But Brock knew it was our girl. Instinct. Got her ID by matching against her dental records. I breathed, the air rich with pine sap, the smell of damp stone. A beautiful place to rest. I read what Brock said. In the newspapers, I said. That stuff about Mersault killing himself? He knew that Patrick Mersault was murdered. He never believed Patrick Mersault killed his own family, did he? I was told his story was a cover. Nestor laughed. Yeah, you could say that, he said. In fact, you asked why I quit the FBI. There were other things, but we had Patrick Mersault's body. It was a clear homicide. But word comes down through Brock that we talk about it like a suicide. We were told a man killed his family, then killed himself. Stick to the script. I couldn't handle that. The outright lies we were supposed to live with. Then we find Marion's body years later, but hold to that same line. Patrick Mersault was killed. Plain as day. He didn't kill himself. It just didn't wash with me.
They still investigated the homicide, though, didn't they? I asked. You interviewed a woman. Onyango?
Nicole, said Nestor.
We found pictures of her at Fleece's place, I said. I saw in the case file she was having an affair with Mersault. Lasted a few years.
Yeah, I remember who she is, said Nestor. If I remember right, the lodge kept license plate numbers. Tracked her down that way.
Nothing panned out with her?
No, not at all, said Nestor. We brought her in the day after you found Mersault. Maybe a day after that. I interviewed her for 2 days straight, but she couldn't tell us much.
What did she tell you?
Mersault picked her up in some bar, said Nestor. Knew that Nicole was a nurse, and wanted to talk with her because he was suffering PTSD. She worked at an assisted living facility. Didn't know how to help him, but that interaction started their relationship. They'd meet at the lodge.
I recognized the Nicole I knew. She inhabited that bar like a conversation piece hung in a dull room. Maybe only a trick of fate that Mersault had drifted into Mare's. But once he saw her, once he heard her speak, he wouldn't have wanted that voice to silence. I knew nothing about Mersault, but pictured him falling in love with Nicole. A quick fall. Did you talk to her again once you found Marion? Ask her again about the daughter?
No, said Nestor. We took another look at the case when we found Marion, wondering if we'd missed anything, seeing if any leads would come out of the discovery. But this was, what, 2003, 2004? Our priorities had changed after 9/11. We didn't have the resources to track down all the loose ends with this. Our office was focusing on cybercrime and the war on terror. Brock had made peace with Patrick Mersault. The DA was happy. NCIS was still investigating, but without our involvement for the most part. We tried to consult with you, actually, bring you in, but no one could track you down. I thought you would have wanted to be here when we found her.
I would have, yes, I said. Where was she laid to rest?
Back in Cannonsburg, with her family.
Her dad, too?
Yeah, they were all cremated.
You remember Fleece's place? I asked. The ship, made of fingernails?
I remember.
Whatever came of that? I asked.
Fact, I remember we were working with the coroner, said Nestor, trying to figure a way we could tell if the fingernails and toenails were missing on Marion, but it was impossible.
What happened when you found her?
Nothing. There was some play in the newspapers, said Nestor. But Brock didn't want to release all the details. Didn't want people traipsing up here.
You never came close to figuring out who killed her? I asked. After all this time? Nestor shook his head.
Never came close.
Shadows had gathered in the trees. I saw fireflies. Nestor sat on a rock, bundled in his wool jacket. We can observe this place, I thought. There's plenty of tree cover. We can have someone posted in a blind. Watch who shows up, who builds the cairns. I need you to show me this place on a map, I said. I need detailed instructions on how to get up here. What roads and that access route you took. Detailed enough so that if I had to get back up here sometime and didn't have any of these markers, I could still get here. Can you do that for me?
I'll mark it all out on a map for you, he said. You must be freezing. Let's get you back. I'll buy you some supper.
Nestor lit our path with a maglight, but even so, finding my footing was difficult coming downhill. Never sure where to plant my silicone foot, I couldn't feel if dirt or rocks were about to give way in slides. I misstepped, tumbling, gashed my knee. I held onto branches and grabbed hold of boughs, still slipping, my palms sap sticky and roughed up from catching myself on needles.
Here,
said Nestor, offering his arm. I took it, steadied myself against him. I put my arm around him, clamped myself to him, walking hip to hip the rest of the way down the hill. He held me beside him. Thank you, I said, frustrated that I'd needed his help at all. I don't like to get myself in a position like that, to rely on people.
I was all right with it, he said.
We ate together in Buchanan, at a place near the river called the Whistle Stop Grill. We sat in one of the booths, the tablecloth, brown gingham covered with a heavy plastic sheet. The decor was like a country kitchen, an old hutch, a fireplace. The walls were wood paneling hung with wreaths. We each ordered steak, onion rings. Nestor poured from a pitcher of Yingling. I like this place, I told him.
Yeah, I'm kind of a regular here. They have good food.
She's pretty, I said, catching sight of the bartender, a woman who looked Black Irish.
You ever talk with her? Annie? Yeah, he said. I bet I'll have to explain you the next time I'm in.
Is she your girlfriend? I don't want to mess things up for you.
No, not a girlfriend. I had someone serious for a while. A few years back. But one day you wake up and realize you're ruining each other, he said. Sometimes even the good things don't quite stick. Sometimes they do.
Warmed by the flirtation kindling between us. No consequences here. I wanted to take his hand in mine. I brushed my knee against his, and he didn't pull away. Thanks for taking me out there, I said.
You think that's everything you'll need?
He asked.
Do you have to present your case review or anything? Write a report?
Not for a little while yet, I said. I'll be around.
Good. It's been good seeing you, he said.
I lingered with Nestor out by his truck, wishing he didn't have that muff of a beard. But when he said,
I've thought about you so much over the years.
I kissed him anyway, finding his lips soft through the field of hair. I could tell he wasn't expecting me, not so readily. But he kissed me and gave in like he was trying to drink me. I could feel the want in him. He cupped my breast as he kissed my neck. There's people around, I said, and Nestor said.
I'm sorry.
Stepping back like he'd offended me or had transgressed. So I said, where do you live? Near here? I followed his taillights down 151, Old Elkins Road, about 20 minutes until he pulled into the long gravel drive. A front porch light. I parked behind the truck, followed him to the side door.
I could never fix this lock,
he said, nudging it open. He let the dog out, a jumpy setter who scrambled into the yard and ran off into the dark. Nestor kissed me in the mudroom, pulled me to him. I kissed his eyes, kissed him. I felt him hard through his jeans, so I touched him, rubbed him while we kissed. He touched my hair like something precious and kissed the strands. He led me through the kitchen.
Through here,
he said, into the living room. A mirror above the mantel reflected our dark forms. He approached in the mirror behind me, his hands folded over my breasts. I felt him push against me from behind. Breathless, he turned me toward him, fumbled at my shirt buttons, so I helped him, spreading open my clothes, revealing myself. Nestor unbuttoned my jeans, fell to his knees as he guided my clothes down over my hips. He kissed my prosthesis, kissed my other thigh, kissed the length of my leg, higher, tasted me. He reached up and held my breasts, and my knee went weak, and I collapsed down with him to the carpet. I helped him remove my prosthesis, laughing with him at the release of the vacuum seal. The sound it made, peeling off the liner, embarrassed when he kissed my stump, knowing how it would smell, how the liner would have made my skin smell. But he kissed me there. Kissed me. He kissed the line above my hair, golden there, working his way up my belly before taking each breast in his mouth and sucking. I shivered, arched myself, welcoming, and he pushed at me, entering me, pulling out only as he came.
"I'm sorry," he said. "That was so fast. I'm sorry."
And he used his mouth and then his fingers until I clenched and shuddered and cried out, panting. We slept for a little over an hour on the living room carpet. Woke up kissing. I used my mouth on him, then guided him into me. We watched each other's eyes this second time, less needy than before. Throw pillows and a blanket from the back of the couch, we curled up together on the floor. He touched my left thigh and kept his hand resting there. I wondered if he thought it was a sign of courage to touch me there, or a gesture of acceptance, or if he was attracted to the missing limb as some men were. But I didn't want to ask him. Just wanted him to indulge in whatever he needed from me.
"How did you lose your leg?"
he asked, sometime after midnight.
"Or were you born like this?"
My eyes had adjusted, and in the ambience of moonlight I noticed the strange painting above the television. A painting of a body, lying supine, and I worried it might be a naked woman, something tacky like Davy Gimm's swimsuit posters, but realized it was a painting of a dead man. "What is that?" I asked. "You didn't paint it, did you?"
"No, I didn't paint it. It was here when I bought the place, and I just never took it down," he said. "The guy who facilitated the sale of the house wanted me to have it. Said it has something to do with a Russian novel. It's just a poster of some old painting. A picture of Jesus."
"You could hang one of your own photographs," I said.
"A painting of the dead Christ is worse than crime scene photographs.
You've got to have something else."
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Maybe I'll swap it out. I have some shots of Yellowstone I like. One of the Grand Prismatic Spring. But you know, that painting. I used to be religious. I was raised in the church."
"I remember you asked me if I believed in the resurrection," I said. "You thought it might help me, being around so much death."
"That's right,"
he said.
"That sounds like something I would have said. But I had an experience around that time. Like a religious experience, but in reverse, I guess you could say. Have you ever had a religious experience? Like you heard the voice of God?"
I thought of seeing Earth from the distance of space, the near holy connectedness to every facet of creation in that moment. "No," I said. "Nothing religious, nothing like that. I've found beauty in nature, but nothing like hearing voices."
"I had. It was like I had a vision of God. But God was like a black hole," said Nestor. "The vision overwhelmed me. People talk about what infinity is, and they think of things that are never-ending. But infinity cuts the other way, too. Infinity can be a negation. We grow from dirt, and our cells multiply, and we grow and wear out and rot, and more are taking our place. It's disgusting, all the bodies and death, billions of us. It's like the tide, washing in and washing out. All that religion, that bullshit about God, it's like that shit you believe as a child, and one day wonder how you ever believed anything at all. Childish things. And everything changed for me after that vision, that experience. I started drinking to blunt the terror I'd felt. I was just so scared of the world. I couldn't stomach the Bureau anymore. I moved out here, just drinking to lose myself. And I would watch that painting of Christ, convince myself that he might sit up, hoping he would somehow sit up to prove me wrong. But every night, I figure this painting is a depiction of Jesus after he's been taken from the cross. and he's just dead. A dead body. And everyone's waiting for the resurrection. And he's waiting for his own resurrection. But it's not going to happen. I hated that painting because of how unchristian it felt to me. But then I realized what its message was. I dug deeper, found deeper meaning.
"You're an atheist," I said.
"No, I believe in God. I believe God exists. I had an experience. I had that vision. And in the vision, I saw God. God is a pestilent light ringed with black stars. I'm still a man of faith because I believe. But when I think of God, I think of something like a parasite."
His heart was racing. He had broken into a cold sweat. His body was silvery in the moonlight. A small constellation of moles dotted his chest, like the belt of Orion over his heart. I didn't know what to say.
"I'm sorry. And I'm sorry I asked about your leg," he said. "I didn't mean to offend you. You must get tired of everyone asking you about it."
"The truth is, I don't even remember it happening," I said. "I was lost in the woods. Hypothermia had set in. My leg had turned gangrenous. They had to amputate. I remember the amputation." A car passed on 151, and the headlights flashed momentarily on the wall, crept in a grid of window panes across the ceiling. I wondered if we had turned cold to each other, just like that, after getting what we'd wanted. But Nestor put his hand on my hair, petted me, pulled me closer to him. I put my arm around him, and he lowered his head onto my breasts. I felt the rising and falling of his breath, knew he could hear my heartbeat. "I had a local anesthetic, but was awake," I told him, remembering the surgery in zero-G, the blood globules squirting in rushes, smearing against the ceiling, the walls. "I was awake, but I couldn't watch. I just looked at the ceiling the whole time. They cut across my shin first, removed my ankle and foot. That's the cut I sometimes think I still feel, a phantom sensation. Sometimes I feel a sever across my shin. The infection had already risen to my knee, though, so they had to take the rest." After a time, Nestor helped me put on my prosthesis. He said,
"It doesn't bother me, just so you know. The moment I first saw you, I wanted to be with you."
"You don't remember when you first saw me," I said.
"I saw you for just a second that night at the crime scene. You caught my eye, and in that meeting room the next morning, I was supposed to introduce myself to you. I already knew you were good-looking, but Jesus Christ, Shannon, when I saw you that morning..."
"All right, that's enough."
"And after you left, I couldn't stop thinking about you. There was this other case, and I thought we might cross paths, but we never did. I was hoping..."
"I would have liked to cross paths," I said. "What did I miss?"
"Just a waste of time for us. Some guy from Harrisburg, some lawyer," said Nestor. "He was killed in a carjacking. We wanted to consult with you."
"What did he have to do with me?"
"Nothing. Erroneous reports,"
he said.
"We were working with a database of ballistic fingerprints, and the bullets they recovered from this lawyer matched the bullets we'd recovered from Mersault. So I thought of you. But we'd had the gun in our evidence room all that time. We wanted to call you in to testify that this match was a false positive, but we couldn't find you. I couldn't find you."
"What happened with the prosecution?"
"The judge threw everything out," said Nestor. "That damn database spit out a handful of ballistics matches. Everything went under review."
"You miss the work?" I asked.
"Sometimes," he said. "But after I..."
"You don't have to talk about this."
"I shot a man. In the line of duty. It was justified in self-defense. But I couldn't live with what I'd done," said Nestor. "He'd pulled a gun on me. Fired shots."
I tried to reconstruct him. Reconstruct his past. A past he might not ever come to have. Visions of God, a parasite, a pestilent star. Some sort of break, maybe. Or maybe killing the man had broken him. Who was he? I asked.
Some big shot. A computer guy. An engineer, said Nestor. His name came up as part of an investigation. Military secrets used for private gain. I went to interview him, that's all. We weren't even targeting him, but he panicked. I was put on leave. The shooting became an internal matter. They tell you you're innocent until proven guilty. But that wasn't my sense. I was ostracized within the Bureau even though I was cleared. Graham V. Connor.
And you left the FBI, I said.
I hope this doesn't sound pathetic, he said. But I'd search for you on the internet, hoping for a picture. Just one picture of you. But there was nothing. I would just let my memory of you play around in my mind, imagining what a life would have been like with you. I even asked around about you, but no one knew. Brock didn't know. But here you are.
Here I am, I said. And I'm thirsty. What do you have around here? Looking at the picture of the dead Christ while I waited for my drink. The body was gray. Holbein, it read. The canvas was narrow, the body stretched out. Impossible to imagine that the body would breathe again. We sat in lawn chairs out on his front porch, bundled in quilts. We drank cognac from coffee mugs, watching distant headlights. Nestor's dog, Buick, curled at his feet, snoring as he chased some rabbit in his dreams. Comfortable in each other's silence nearing 3 a.m., my mind wandered to Marion's body, buried among the pines, and roving cities built in the shape of pyramids. "What's deeper than Christ?" I asked. "You said you looked at that painting and found something deeper than the miracles you once believed in. What's deeper than Christ?"
"The eternal forest," said Nestor. "All around us. Everything you can see."
Too cold to stay outside, we went to his bed, and he drifted off, but I stayed awake and watched the dawn glow pink and orange on the walls. I remembered Nestor's father's dream. He had dreamed he was trapped in a mine and crawled through the black tunnels until he came to a labyrinth of forest. The mirrored room, the tree of bones. I, too, had been lost in the eternal forest. I considered waking Nestor, to talk with him or kiss him one last time, but left my cell number on the nightstand and let him sleep. 3. Miserable weather. Spring slush glazed the sidewalks like a skin of chilled pudding. 6 months living here. I was Courtney here. I belonged here. A cripple on disability checks. Mountaineers, sweatshirts, and baggy sweatpants. My hair scraggly and long, unkempt. 6 months and I blended in. Part of the fabric, like the abandoned storefronts, the grimy windows curtained or covered with plywood, facades browned with rain-streaked muck. The stairs of the Palatial Beaux-Arts courthouse were filled with smokers, ratty men with nothing to fill their time but loiter, their bodies bent against the rain. Sleet soaked my sweatshirt, my hair, a heavy weight, cold. I'd made myself a regular at Mayor's on nights without Nestor, settling into this if. I spent New Year's here, Christmas. I shook off the slush, took my seat at the far end of the bar, an end stool where I could see the TV, but still have my view of the room. Mayor's in neon blue cursive behind the bar, cigarette smoke like gauze. The regular bartender was a young woman named Bex, her left arm sleeved with tattoos, hyacinths and vines. She poured my first drink, rum and cherry coke.
"Starting a tab tonight, Courtney."
"Yeah," I said. "And I'll pick up Coles tonight, if she comes in." She swept in from the rain nearing 7. Her routine, long-limbed and elegant, her presence a glamour undiminished by middle age, even rain soggy and exhausted from her shift. Powder blue scrubs, a cherry red raincoat, she took her usual stool next to mine. "Cole," I said. Gim? Already smoking a parliament, she pulled over one of the plastic ashtrays and blew a smoke ring my way before tapping out her ash. I puckered and kissed the center of the smoke as it melted across my face. Menthol and wet fabric and a whiff of body odor, maybe from the elderly bodies she'd handled and washed and wiped through the day at the assisted living center. Her eyes were bloodshot, and she seemed drowsy tonight, lighting a second cigarette before finishing her first, the two smoldering together in the ashtray. Vicodin, I guessed. Easy to know when she was using.
I need a Manhattan, she said, rubbing her eyes.
You all right? I asked.
Long day,
she said, her voice graced with that musical accent. I'd learned that she'd moved from Mombasa when she was a teenager.
I've got your drinks tonight, I said. Ah, your SSI check must have cleared, she said. Largesse.
I raised my glass. To life in the welfare state, I said, but after a pause. I remember what today is.
April 16th.
April 16th, I said. Her husband had passed away from thyroid cancer, I knew, 10 years ago today, too early for the cure. I didn't know much about him, a guy named Jared. They'd married young, and I had the impression her marriage to Jared had been troubled from the start. He had abused her. She told me once she'd suffered a broken jaw, that he had hit her. I knew they'd been estranged for a number of years before he died. Nicole and I had grown close these past few months, and I felt like she poured her life into me, like I was her vessel. She talked freely about her painful past, a hard life, chasing drugs after her husband died, waking up in strange rooms with men, trading favors for stamp bags. Her life wasn't as wild now. Age had mellowed her. But she still used, still drank, still tried to erase the ache that coiled within her.
I almost forgot, she said,
digging through her purse, drawing 5 scratch-off lottery cards from a side pocket. She fanned them out, slid them to me.
I didn't win shit with mine, she said.
Pills mixed with liquor. She was woozy, moved like her bones were liquefying. Tonight might end like some of our other nights together when she was using, pushing her to drink, pushing her to more pills if she had them. Sometimes she'd pass out, and I'd get her to my apartment next door, stay up with her to make sure her breathing didn't stop. But other nights, the pills and liquor just made her lose herself, stripped the shell from her, and I'd turn off the apartment lights and listen to her stream of chatter. Those nights I'd lead our conversations, tell her I wanted to hear about old loves, just 2 girls talking. And she'd talk about her dead husband and affairs she'd had, and her regrets over a lover who had died. Mersault, I'd think, and ask for more. But she would mix her stories of dead lovers with violent nightmares, carry on conversations without me as if she could hear the dead speaking to her from a great distance until she slipped under. She finished her Manhattan, called for a second. I flipped through the lottery cards, the gold mine. I scraped silver crud from icons of miners' tools but came up a bust.
Son of a bitch. Don't scratch them all at once, said Nicole.
Mares had always been a bar for regulars, but had been adopted by frackers. Southerners, mostly, coming through southwestern Pennsylvania to tap the shale. Truckers and roughnecks, a scourge that would pass once this area was depleted. They filled mares almost every night now, turning the dive rowdy. A group of men played pool, talking loopholes in the dumping laws. They were boisterous and drank too much, their southern twang somehow a more foreign sound than even Nicole's Kenyan lilt. Nicole was known here, had been coming to Mare since the early 90s at least. The bar about a half-hour walk from her apartment over at Castle Tower, and within walking distance of her job at the Donnell House. 2 decades, the same routine, and I was part of her routine now too. The bartenders called us Cole and Court, like we were a set, or the odd couple, and eventually we spent some time together outside of Mare's, on weekends, visiting each other's apartment and taking quick road trips in Nicole's Honda, usually up to Pittsburgh to pick through the record stores, Nicole, an eclectic collector of chansons and medieval polyphony and dissonant classical music. Strange things, she said, reminded her of childhood. She swirled the ice in her drink. Prone to tunnel vision tonight, I noticed. Usually Nicole was erratic when she was using. But tonight, she was turned inward.
They are having a memorial service for Jarrett, she said. Out on their property. They want me to come out, but I haven't seen those people in ages.
What people?
My in-laws, said Nicole. Jared's mother, Miss Ashley. She has a large property, wants to have the family over.
Is that a good idea? Nicole shrugged, took a drag from one of her cigarettes. She had told me about her husband's suffering, the cancer, how he'd begged her back following his diagnosis, how she'd nursed him until he died. His family was close-knit, his cousins or close friends of his, and they were an unhealthy influence on Nicole. She used heavily after the last time she saw them, she said, a spiral that had flattened out only after some time had passed. But the damage was done, and she could never quite kick the heroin. For a few days? What could come of it? I asked.
I could tell you, said Nicole, gazing at the television.
KDKA teased their 11 o'clock news. A family killed. A lethal crash on 65. A pit bull burned alive.
I could tell you some things.
The pills were affecting her. She seemed like she was dissolving. Her gestures were loose, and she drank her Manhattan in gulps. So tell me, I said, trying to make myself seem hollow for her, like anything she'd want to unburden would fit inside. She thought I was simple, I knew that. I helped her feel that way. That I was good for a laugh and to talk shit about the men at the bar, but wasn't someone with greater designs. That talking to me was almost like talking with an empty room. Cole, I said.
I fucked a friend of his. I didn't care, she said. I wanted to hurt him.
I tried to focus through my own wash of alcohol. The glare of the television, a rise of voices around the pool table. Tim McGraw on the jukebox. I waved at Bex for another round. Who was the guy?
Patty,
said Nicole.
Patrick,
taking another drink.
He was married, so we met in hotels, in a cabin he used to rent. He would fuck me, then take pictures so I could mail them to my husband, so he would know I was with someone else. Jared would drift in and out of my life, bring all his shit with him. I wanted to hurt him.
Patrick Mersault, I thought, a rise of heat through my neck, imagining Mersault and Nicole's adultery. Nicole posing for him in the cabin at Blackwater and mailing photographs to her husband like she was sending packets of poison. What happened? I asked. Nicole gestured at the TV.
It was on the news, she said,
her eyes welling. She wiped away tears, seemed nauseous. Some memory passed over her and she shook her head.
Did your husband kill him? I asked.
Jared was a coward, said Nicole,
vacant, delayed, the liquor pushing her deeper.
I fell in love with him because he had this tattoo, and I was just 17 when I met him, and that tattoo was all it took to impress me. This eagle on his chest. He said he liked my jacket. He was my worst mistake.
Jesus, Cole, what are you telling me? Did your husband kill someone?
His friends did. Our friends. Cobb did, and Carl, said Nicole. And after, he would call every night and threaten me. Said he would kill me for what I did to him, or if I said anything. He ruined everything about me. He took everything good and ruined it. I wish I would have died when I was 17 instead of living this hell.
Who are these guys? I asked her. Carl and Cobb?
You never mentioned them before. They were friends of yours.
That was a long time ago, said Nicole, finishing her Manhattan. She chewed the ice.
I'll go with you to the memorial service, I said, wondering who would gather at a service for her husband. A man named Cobb and a man named Carl had killed Patrick Mersault, and Nicole's husband, Jared, was involved somehow, too. And this if Jared had died of thyroid cancer in 2006. But he would still be alive in 1997. I can find him.
Take me with you.
No, I don't think that's a good idea, said Nicole. These people...
You shouldn't go alone, I said. After what you just told me?
I can't let you go alone.
Christ, Nicole.
I'll come with you. It will be all right. You need a friend with you.
I guess so, maybe, she said. Let me think about it. I guess I don't want to be alone.
Nicole excused herself to the bathroom, and I ordered us another round. I wasn't a friend. I was a manipulation. I was a lie. But every truth here was a lie. I was buzzing. Three suspects for the Mersault deaths. I texted Nestor, let him know about the weekend, that I wouldn't be around. Come over tonight, he wrote back. But I texted, it's late, and he replied, tomorrow.
Ah, hell, said Bex.
Nicole, returning from the bathroom, stumbling. She bumped into someone and almost sprawled.
Hold on a sec, I said. Bex, go ahead and swipe my card. I've got to get her out of here.
A 20 on the bar. A tip. I looped Nicole's purse over my shoulder.
Come on, Cole,
I said. We're going up to my place. Her arm draped over my shoulders. Nicole, just a slip, like she was made of air.
You'll be all right, I said. You're just drunk, that's all. We're getting you home.
You need help, asked Bex.
We'll manage, I said. She can still walk,
knowing how ridiculous we looked. Mares hadn't been rollicking, but outside the night was silent. Rain fell, an icy haze. I tested the sidewalk to see if it was frozen before trusting my fake foot. We made our way up the flight of stairs to my room, spotting her as we climbed. 3B. I unlocked the deadbolt.
Just lie on the couch.
She sagged to the futon, coughing, her legs hanging over one of the armrests. A gurgling belch. I smelled the tang of boozy vomit and checked her over. She had messed her shirt, her cardigan. I took off her shoes, her soiled clothes. Her breasts were small, her body emaciated, her arms pocked with track marks. She wore her serpent bracelet, and a necklace I first thought was a vivid sapphire because of its brilliance. But when I looked closely, I saw the iridescent blue was actually the petal of some exquisite flower embedded in resin. The necklace was stunning, the shade of blue unreal. I dressed her in one of my sweaters, covered her with a blanket. The blue of the flower petals, such a strange blue, I thought, turning out the apartment lights. Such a breathtaking blue, unlike any shade I'd ever seen. I sat near her, on the floor. Nicole's fingers touched my head, and I realized she was petting me, almost, running her fingers absently through my hair. "You want anything?" I asked, but Nicole had closed her eyes. Her mouth hung open, and soon she snored lightly, like a purring cat. I left the bedroom door open a crack to hear if she stirred, and slid my briefcase from the closet floor, hoisting it to the bed. Printouts I'd made from the library the previous weeks, articles about the Sieges attack, about Marion Mersault. I glanced at a poster that had been distributed in the years before Marion was found. A Have You Seen Me poster, created by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. There were other folders, information about Patrick Mersault. I pulled my copies of the Polaroids we'd found at Elric Fleece's house, in the duffel. Close-up photographs of a black woman's thighs, breasts, stomach, feet. Nicole was healthier then, 19 years ago, her body less worn. Nicole believed that Patrick Mersault had been killed out of jealousy. But Patrick Mersault hadn't been the only victim. His entire family had been killed. Nicole's story had omissions, Time had made her too innocent. Her version of the past was the only version here. But there must be something more. I could imagine a man shooting another man over an affair, ambushing the adulterer at his love nest at the Blackwater Lodge. But I couldn't make the leap into believing that Nicole's husband, or his friends, had butchered Mersault's entire family over an affair. That they had taken Marion Mersault to the woods. A failure of imagination, maybe. An inability to assume the utter worst of people. But someone had killed a woman and two children with an axe, and then killed a 17-year-old girl. I couldn't imagine. I looked out the bedroom windows. A snow squall had swept through, dusting the streets, a glistening white like crystallized sugar. I took off my sleet-damp sweatshirt, draped it over the shower curtain rod to drip dry, then removed my prosthesis and plugged the knee-joint battery into an outlet to charge. Patty, Nicole had said. Patrick. I wondered if his killers were still alive in this if. It would have been 20 years ago that they had found Mersault in the Blackwater Lodge and executed him. I remember the pitch darkness of those cabins at night. Stars and moonlight choked out by pines. I imagined the knock at the door, the interrupted silence, and it occurred to me that Patrick Mersault might have known his killers. Nicole had confessed that she had wanted to hurt her husband when she slept with Patrick, that Patrick was a friend of his. Maybe Mersault knew his killers when they arrived in the night, and maybe they had told him that they'd killed his family, that they'd killed his oldest daughter and left her in the gorge not far from the cabin where they would leave his body, that only a few miles would separate him from his daughter. I went back to the briefcase and pulled Libra's crew list. I found his name. Jared Bitek, machinist's mate, engineering laboratory technician. Nicole's husband had been a sailor on Libra, had known Mersault because they'd served together. As the ELT, he would have worked with the BL drive, would have been the engine room supervisor. Fleece would have reported to him. Heart pounding, I found Cobb, Charles, special warfare operator, another SEAL. And there was a Carl Heildkrugger, the CELNAV, the ship's celestial navigator. They were all sailors on Libra. Mersault wasn't the only MIA surfacing. Libra had returned, or it had never launched. Where was the rest of the crew? These men knew one another. They all knew of Mersault's affair with Nicole. If I could track them down in Terra Firma, I might find Marion. Nicole's breath occasionally hitched. She'd wheeze and roll over. I brought down a comforter to sleep on the floor next to her, and sat up through the night when her sleep was disturbed. Staring at the ceiling much of the night, imagining my sight could pierce every impediment, through the ceiling and the apartment above, through the cover of rain clouds, straight into the night sky, the stars. I tried to imagine that love triangle, Nicole and Jared, Patrick Mersault, but grew distracted by the shadows of the rain, my mind wandering to Fleece, to the tree of bones in the mirrored room, to the ship built of nails that will carry the dead. Missing fingernails. Whoever had killed Mersault's family had taken their fingernails. Nicole gasped. Sounded like she'd swallowed a spurt of vomit before rolling over and breathing again. What would happen if Nicole actually were to die? No one would find her body until the landlord came through. If Nicole were to die during the night, I would pack everything and walk out the front door without turning back. Return to Terra Firma. Let this possibility blink. 4. Buick ran from the mudroom to meet me when I pulled down Nestor's drive, to get his ears rubbed and sniff my tires before scampering through the lawn. Nestor came out onto the front porch, said, "There you are," and kissed me as I came up the front steps. He offered me a record in a brown paper sleeve. "What's this?" I asked him. The last time I saw him, he'd wanted to know how I filled my time when we weren't together, and I'd said my favorite thing in the world was to lie in bed and listen to music. "Just take a look," said Nestor. "Let yourself be surprised." A Cross of Skulls, Nirvana's Lead Belly.
I thought you might like this one, he said. You don't have it, do you?
Not on vinyl, I told him. Good choice. I love it.
I wanted to give you something from 97, when we met,
said Nestor.
The first time we met, this had just come out.
I used to have a Nirvana t-shirt back in college, the one with the transparent angel, all the anatomy. I tore off the sleeves, made a tank top out of it.
I used to do the same thing with my shirts,
he said, lighting a cigarette. Nestor had cleaned up for me, shaved off the beard. He looked years younger without the scruff.
See, if we were friends back then, we could have borrowed each other's clothes.
I don't think mine would have fit you. A breath of summer had pushed through, melting the glaze of snow from the other night, turning the ground muddy. We passed the afternoon in wooden rockers, pulling chilled Yingling bottles from a cooler, watching Buick chase butterflies. We played In the Pines loud enough to hear his living room speakers out in the yard. Steaks and zucchini from the grill for dinner, and after we washed dishes, we took a walk around his property, an expansive field that stretched for close to 7 acres before a strip of woods marked the start of the neighbor's farm. Buick trotted along without a leash, running out through the longer grass before loping back. Nestor and I held hands intermittently, and when I clutched him for balance on the uneven ground, he didn't let go. We reached our usual turning point, out near a ruined Ryder truck, something the previous owners had abandoned in the field. The neighbors' barns were newer, bright red corrugated metal lit with floodlights. Buick barked at the air, probably catching scent of the neighbors' shepherds.
You're distracted, said Nestor.
Yeah, I said. I don't know. Easy to forget myself here, with him, to forget that this world was like a dream. But learning the names of Mersault's killers had been a touch of horror. I wondered if Marion was already dead in Terra Firma, or if I had an opportunity to save her. I wouldn't know until I stepped back into the rushing river of time. Life was perfect here in its way, perfect with Nestor, out here in Buchanan. I found myself trying to memorize Nestor, every detail, knowing I'd leave him someday. Let's head back, I said. We walked in silence for a time, finishing our walk through his uneven side yard, a half acre overgrown with wildflowers. Nestor helped pick foxglove and aster, Buick running ahead of us to the level grass. Darker here, Nestor's house occluding the front porch light and the light from the neighbor's barn. I was remembering nights as a child out in the country like this. The stars so numerous that sometimes I could see the hazy band of the Milky Way. I can't stay the night, I said. I'm taking a trip with a friend of mine, for a memorial service. She's picking me up in the morning. Nestor kissed my forehead. He held me, breathed in the scent of my hair.
I'll miss you.
Just a few days. The sky was clear, and as night fell, I saw stars, but not the ineffable brilliance I remembered from childhood. The horizon glowed, always faintly glowed. Light pollution from somewhere. Light interfering with light. Nicole picked me up in her fit, our first time seeing each other since the other night. She'd slipped away that morning while I still slept, left a handwritten apology and a thank you for the spare sweater. A further act of contrition that she'd brought me a coffee and a croissant for breakfast, something for the road.
You look nice, she said. I've never seen you dressed up.
I'd found a carnation pink day dress at Avalon. It had a tailored fit, nice lines, with a black belt to cinch the waist.
You look good too, I said.
Nicole, effortlessly graceful in her navy blue peacoat and white linen dress. I thought you only owned scrubs. We left Washington south to West Virginia, to Nicole's mother-in-law's home on an orchard outside Mount Zion. Country roads, a stop at a gas station, the only restroom housed in a cinder block hut. I wondered what Nicole remembered from the other night, if she regretted having told me so much. She was quieter than usual, I thought. Or maybe I was reading too much into her not being such a morning person. She put on music to fill the silence, fiddling with the dial until she slid in a CD. I watched birds gliding on outspread wings, riding gusts.
"You all right?" asked Nicole. "You turned pale."
Yeah, I guess so, I said. "Will any of the people who..."
"Let's not talk about that," said Nicole. "Just forget it, right?"
Wondering what faces I would see. Other sailors then Mersault assumed lost but were here, living, as if returned from the dead. And Nicole was in the center of these men somehow. She sang softly to the music, the color of her true love's hair, a resonant voice. Difficult to measure her against her past, a past I didn't fully understand. A murmuration of starlings stippled the sky. They turned together, changed direction like a sentient cloud.
"You won't be at the memorial," said Nicole. "That will just be family. I don't know who will come back to the house after, but some might."
We turned from the main road onto a private drive and passed through rows of fruit trees, some sickly or dead, most erupting in glorious white blossoms, petals on the grass like a spring snow. The house was at the top of a shallow rise. It had a gabled roof, twin stone chimneys. A barn was set on the far side of the rise, a gable roof echoing the house, a salt box shed attached. Neither the house nor the barn was painted, both just the grayed color of plank wood, the lawn dried brown. Nicole parked near the barn. "This is beautiful, Cole," I said. "How often do you make it out here? It's peaceful."
"Never," said Nicole. "Almost never."
The house had spacious rooms, hardwood floors. The windowsills were decorated with antique bottles of colored glass that cast rainbows across the walls. A memorial display had been arranged on the coffee table, I noticed. A small selection of items. A photo album, an American flag in a triangle display case, a pocket watch on a strip of velvet. An old, long rifle hung above the fireplace mantel, from the 1800s or maybe earlier. A bag of powder dangling from the muzzle. I wondered what Nestor would have made of it. The smell of simmering chili filled the house, bread baking.
"Miss Ashley?"
Nicole called out. A woman answered.
"Cole! Oh, I'll be right with you."
The woman was stout, with white hair and ropey braids, her broad cheeks and thick neck marshmallow soft.
"Here you are," she said,
and although she used a cane, she enveloped Nicole in a crushing hug.
"You'll slip through my arms, Cole. You're scrawny. You're too scrawny."
And when Nicole introduced me, Miss Ashley shook my hand and said,
"Courtney, we're well met. Look here, we're each missing something."
She lifted her hem and showed off her prosthetic foot. "Diabetes?" I asked.
"That's right. Had neuropathy," said Miss Ashley. "Type 2, all of a sudden. Lost my vision also, but had a doctor prescribe me those nanobot gel caps. Cured me up. You don't mind a cot in the den, do you?"
"I don't mind," I said. "Thanks for having me."
"Psh," she said. "A friend of Cole's, you know. Shauna and Cobb have their stuff in the spare bedroom. Some of the others got a hotel closer to Spencer."
Cobb. In the same house with him. The seal. I brought my suitcase to the den, in addition to the main house. Brown carpeting. A brake front with American bicentennial plates. A cherrywood 8-gun display case that was empty. I had a view of the wide lawn and the distant orchard. A woman sat on a stool in the side yard, out near an antique horse-drawn plow that was left as decoration. A burlap sack and a bucket at her feet, shucking corn. Her hair fell in copper waves, a bottle color. "This must be Shauna," I thought. I watched her with the corn, breaking off the husk and peeling leaves, picking off strands of silk. She wore camouflage pants and a long-sleeved thermal shirt that hugged her chest. Athletic, but out of her element with the corn. The kind of girl that might buy a pink shotgun. Nicole knocked at the door.
"Will this be all right?" she asked. "Comfortable?"
"Yeah," I told her, looking around at the room, the fold-out cot. "This will be perfect."
I'll have to leave you alone for a little while, she said. Miss Ashley and I are going to meet some of the family. We'll be back for dinner. Cobb's driving us.
That's fine, I said. Will you be all right?
She was thinking it was a mistake to have brought me, I could tell.
I'll be fine, she said. Listen, about all that stuff from the other night. I don't know what I was saying. I don't remember, but I'm sure I was...
Cole, I understand, I said. And I was drinking, too. I don't even remember.
These people, they're my family, she said. I'll be fine. They're good people.
We had coffee at the kitchen table while she waited for Miss Ashley to get ready. Heavy footsteps clambered down the stairs. The man who entered the kitchen was gargantuan, a full foot taller than me at least and broad, the sleeves and back of his suit coat tight against him. Muscled, the bearing of a wrestler gone bulkier as he aged. Scandinavian by way of the Midwest, corn-fed, in his 50s at least, if not older, his white blonde hair a tight crew cut that fuzzed the pinkish folds of his neck. His eyes were close-set and uneven, one slightly higher than the other. Dumb eyes, some people might have thought, but to me his eyes looked like something gone feral.
"Who's this?"
he asked when he noticed me. "Courtney Gim," I said, and we shook hands, my hand in his like a petal wrapped in meat.
"A friend of mine," said Nicole.
"Gim," he said. "All right. I'm Cobb."
"Cobb," I said, and he seemed to like that, hearing his own name repeated. He smiled, a sort of squint-eyed smirk. I imagined him killing Mersault. I imagined him killing a girl. I imagined him killing a girl with his bare hands, strangling the life from her, breaking her neck.
"We'll be back soon," said Nicole.
I watched them leave, Cobb's truck kicking up a plume of dust down the long dirt drive. The floorboards whined as I walked through the house alone. The light fixture at the top of the stairs was pink glass. I found the bedroom Nicole was staying in, wondered if this was the room where Jared Bitek had grown up. If it was, all traces of him were gone. White walls, a wider rectangle where a picture once hung. I went back downstairs, opened the cover of the photo album that was part of the memorial display. A mother's love never ends. Photos of Jared Bitek from elementary school, high school. He looked like a tough kid, I thought, but Miss Ashley had saved every report card. A straight-A student. There was a graduation picture, then grad school, a PhD in chemistry, Penn State. I turned the page and saw a picture of four men. Cobb, shirtless, muscular, his arm around Jared Bitek. Patrick Mersault was in the picture, smoking a cigar. But I didn't recognize the fourth man. About as tall as Cobb, but leaner. A corona of reddish gold hair. The man's head was like a death's head. Sunken cheeks and bony cheekbones. His lips parted, his teeth visible. Shadows covered his eyes.
"You shouldn't be looking at that."
Startled, I closed the album. "I didn't mean to," I said. Turned to see Shauna standing in the doorway. "I was curious. I'm sorry."
"I'm not mad at you," said Shauna. "But they wouldn't want you looking through their stuff. Miss Ashley shouldn't have left this out."
She was my age about, or a few years younger, somewhere in her 30s. When she pulled her hair back, a sensation of déjà vu washed over me, like I had seen her pull her hair back before. I noticed a tattoo in the cleft of her left hand, a black circle with crooked spokes. "I just wanted to see what Jared looked like," I said.
"Come on, let's get out of here," said Shauna. "I'll show you the orchard."
There were paths through the fruit trees that led to the road. The trees bloom but get blitzed by late frosts each year, so some of the petals had browned, fallen. Apple and pear trees mostly, nothing ready to pick yet. But Shauna spoke fondly of walking here in summer, gathering fruit for pies. My mind wandered as we walked, thinking of Njoku, of his ship, Cancer, Cancer had sailed deep time, and I wondered if the same had been true of Libra.